Before there was Antony and Cleopatra, there was Caesar and Cleopatra, which also made for a great story, a story of love and violence and global politics, not to mention murder in specific. And among those who turned it into art was Handel, who made a full-fledged Italian opera out of it. How did his English audiences of the 1720s react to a German composer writing an Italian opera? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What were the operas like in England of 300 years ago, and how do performers today carry through the traditions of those times? We have three guests who can provide plenty of insights. They're William Florescu, the general director of the Florentine Opera Company of Milwaukee, and two performers in the March 28th and 30th productions of Handel's Julius Caesar, countertenor Ian Howell, who sings the part of Ptolemeo, and mezzo-soprano Adriana Zabala, who plays the part of Sesto.
Oh, welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you.
We're glad to be here. Thanks.
Let's start with you, Bill, in terms of the choice to do Julius Caesar and what kind of place this opera holds in the opera world. It's not as common as many others, right?
No, though, I think that's changing. For us doing it, it's really an intersection of two things. This is our 80th anniversary, and we're celebrating the Italian heritage of the company, so we're doing an all-Italian season. But I still wanted to give it a little bit of a crease instead of just doing everything the obvious choice. And then the other thing is we've had quite a bit of success over the past several seasons of introducing Baroque opera to our repertory. Ian was involved in our Baroque double bill a couple of years ago. So I think those two things came to fruition. I guess the third point also is that the folks that I wanted to populate this cast became available, and I really thought they would make a great cast for it. So Julius Caesar's, in a lot of ways, the first great masterpiece in the standard repertory, and after 80 years, I think we were long overdue to do it. So
sometimes considered Handel's greatest opera, and I guess there are many candidates for that role. How does the performance of a Baroque opera compare, and we'll stick with Italian opera in particular, compare with what you might hear if you were going to hear a 19th century Italian opera? In a way, is it a more gentle introduction to an opera goer?
I don't think this production will seem gentle. I mean, it's full-bodied. I mean, we're not being precious china glass approach to Baroque opera. This is full-bodied singing, playing. I mean, we're certainly being stylistic, but I think that people should expect to be involved dramatically as well as musically. Our director, Eric Einhorn, who has done a lot of great work, and I was glad to have him back after Turandot, we're approaching it as an opera. And I think, my view, the best way to approach doing a Baroque opera is we're doing an opera. I think this idea of sort of resetting and saying we're doing something different is a mistake, because then you sort of fulfill the audience's expectations of going into something that they're not going to get.
So it's not an oratorio, which, no. You know, Handel, of course, started writing later where it was more static. This
right.
is a full-bodied theatrical production.
Absolutely. With virtuoso singing. I mean, I think that's the other thing. If you like drama, if you like history, and if you like incredible singing, this would be a fantastic piece for you to come to.
What about the sort of gender roles? That's kind of intriguing in this production, right? Where sometimes, you would have expected Julius Caesar and in Handel's time to be played by a castrata, right?
Correct. I think, and Ian's an expert on this, but I think Senesino was the famous countertenor of Handel's time, or castrato, excuse me, not countertenor. But it's been done the first great production this country was the New York City Opera production of 1966, which was Norman Schlegel, who was a bass. What turned me onto the opera was when I was studying in England, I heard the great mezzo-soprano Janet Baker do an incredible performance. David Daniels, more recently in our time, has done a lot of productions of it. So I think it's really open season.
So you're saying all of those have played Caesar?
Correct.
From a bass to a soprano?
Correct.
Now, why is that?
Because one can argue that the timbre should be that of a castrato or a countertenor, but in terms of it being a lower voice, the bass can do it. And plus, it was created for Norma Traigle at New York City Opera. That actually caused a lot of tension because what it really turned out to be was Beverly Sills' coming out party. And Norma Traigle was somewhat bitter after that because it was done for him and it made her a star. But I think today that's rarely done. I think we've sort of settled into it either being a countertenor or a mezzo-soprano most of the time. But occasionally you see some basses do it.
So tell us what you're doing in your production with it. What will we hear?
We will hear a mezzo-soprano, Deanne Meek, do it.
But dressed as a man.
Dressed as a man. As well as Sesto. Adriana is doing Sesto, or Sextus, the son. so that's also... Now, a third role that should be a cross-dressing role, Nireno, we've actually made the decision just to turn him into a woman, calling him Nirena instead of Nireno. And so we have a woman doing it. So it's... bring your scorecard.
Gender Sudoku.
And are you staging it as if in ancient Egypt? No.
18th century or no. What, 21st century?
Where we're doing it right before the First World War.
And, oh, really?
And so really what you see is still the same dynamic between Italy and Northern Africa.
Sure.
But sort of pre-fascist Italy.
Wow.
And the relationships still, I think, work very well in that context. So, it's because, a lot of times when you see Julius Caesar, when people say, oh, you're doing a period production of it, what you're really doing is a production where people are dressed in Baroque clothes.
Well, right.
Which is an update even by itself. So not many people really do it in ancient Egypt.
Well, that raises an interesting question. In 18th century opera, were those costumes just, in effect, everyday wear for the performers? Or did they do things in costume from their perspective?
I think my colleagues both who may delve into this more than I do, but certainly Ian might want to, can probably address that a little more educatedly.
Sure. You have to wrap your mind around theatrical conventions of the 17th and 18th century. If what we're talking about was a production by Handel's troupe in London of Julius Caesar, was it somehow accurate or not accurate based on the clothing that they're wearing? And so let's just step back because this was music about presenting superstar singers. These were the rock stars of the time. If Cuzzoni wore a certain type of dress, then a week later all of the young debutantes would be wearing that dress. So, it's perhaps a little bit apocryphal, but there are even stories that Senesino, who is the great castrato for whom Julius Caesar the role was written, insisted that at the top of every act he would have to enter on horseback regardless of what the scene was about.
That's in my writer as
well. It's in most of ours. So this is the world that we're looking at. So this was opera seria. This was not opera buffa. This was not Commedia dell'arte based performances, but the way in which it was made formal was not by being realistic in sort of a Verismo sort of way. It was very much about a gesture. Yeah, and the stars basically acting out poses, specific ways that they would hold their hands, specific ways that their costumes would look, specific ways that they would stand in position relative to one another to create a certain sort of tableau that affected the audience in a way because they recognized all these gestures from ancient Greek and ancient Roman statues and from the proportions that they would see within Renaissance paintings as well.
There's a great story about Francesca Cuzzoni. Would Handel have written the Cleopatra?
Yeah, she premiered
part
Cleopatra.
In this opera for her. And she was the superstar in other Handel operas, Ostinate and before this, I think, and Atone afterward. Mm-hmm. And she was notoriously temperamental, not so good to look at, apparently. I guess the costumes helped. But in one instance, she would not sing this Handel aria in rehearsal. And he grabbed her by the waist and threatened to throw her out the window if she didn't sing it. And she did comply, but apparently she was. And then later, I think it was in Otone, she actually got in a fist fight on stage with another soprano.
Yeah, that was with Faustina.
Yes, Faustina Bordoni.
We only had one of those things happen. We're doing pretty well.
It throws the plot off track when those spontaneous things happen.
Well, and if you look at the pay sheets for these operas, these people were being paid astronomical figures. I think
for the time.
I mean, the seed money for Handel's venture when he started writing Italian opera in London was, I believe, about £17,000. That's what he raised in subscriptions.
Yeah.
And Cuzzoni's salary for the first year was, I believe, $2,000 of that. So
yeah, wow. That's quite a percentage.
So there you go. Yeah,
Adriana, I was curious, when you sing the part of a male, do you do something different with your voice?
No, it's a great question. No, I don't do anything different with my voice. And interestingly, amid all the sort of scorecard keeping of how the parts were originally written for either castrati or for male voices or female voices, my role is unusual in that it was actually a male character originally written for soprano. So maybe, and I know that the tenors have played sesto, I think.
Right. Domingo recorded the aria.
Domingo recorded the aria, and I'm also thinking of our wonderful leader hero who passed just last year, whose name is escaping me, also played it very famously. But it's one of the few that originally written for soprano or mezzo-soprano and still is most often sung by soprano or mezzo-soprano. So it's a great question. I don't do anything different for my voice because the composition is such that it would be for the same range mm-hmm. as it would be if it were a Rosina character, for example, or a Zerlina. I'm thinking about Mozart operas. Of course, it's also similar to Cherubino, which is another trouser role. You do change your physicality, of course. And at this point, that's something that I don't think about overly conscientiously because it has become sort of a normal part of what I'm doing on stage. I'm very often playing pants roles. I enjoy it very much. I had a mentor early on who gave me some insight into playing male characters with sincerity that I've always taken with me, I'd say, for the last 20 years or so, which is to, it's also a wonderfully broad-minded thing to say to a young singer, which was find the true male in yourself. Find the true person. Don't make it a caricature. Mm-hmm. Don't go around, you know, scratching yourself and walking ridiculously. And, because we've unfortunately all seen that. And, yeah. And I would say that in our world today, among my amazing colleagues all over the world, everyone takes, I think, unless the production calls for some heightened sense of irony, a lot of mezzo-sopranos tend to take a very realistic view and care for their male characters. And so the audience knows I'm a woman. So we're not trying to do something literal to fool them. But what I am trying to find physically, and of course also in the voice, just as I would in any character, the sincerity of the mm-hmm. character.
She's being a little modest, too, because she did our Cherubino last year, and Adriana is really one of the best on stage, I think, of inhabiting that. And you believe it's not a contrived physicality, but it seems very natural. And her Cherubino last year was fantastic in that regard. So it's a real art to be able to do that, and I think it's really the best art when it's unselfconscious, which is what I think she brings to
there. There is this long tradition in opera of disguises which are gender crossing. You know, men pretending to be women. I think always for comic effect. Women pretending to be men, not necessarily for comic effect. But what is the whole logic behind pants roles?
Well, you know, it's not just musical because when Beaumarchais wrote the original play of The Marriage of Figaro, the role of Cherubino in the original French play was also intended to be played by a girl mm-hmm. playing a boy. So I think it's a timbre thing on stage that they wanted to do. But one of the really interesting things that's happened with updating productions, and I found this with Ida Maneo, because when people see your updating production, they assume that when you have a woman singing a man's role, that's something that you've added on that had nothing to do with what the original composer did. Mm-hmm. So when we updated Ida Maneo, people thought I had made the decision to make Ida Mante a mezzo-soprano and that I was making some type of sexuality statement about it, as opposed to the fact that I was doing, and Mozart did write a tenor version of it, but he did intend it for a mezzo-soprano. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the dangers of updating, because they think everything you're doing is a statement as opposed to being historically informed.
Are you adding anything? I saw a review of the New York Met version of Julius Caesar where apparently they added a Bollywood song,
yeah, that's
right?
The David McVicker production yes. that was at Glyndebourne at the Met and at the Lyric. We're not doing that. I mean, Eric is doing some really interesting things, but I would call it a more naturalistic. I think the McVicker production sort of buys in more to just sort of owning the stylization of it and sort of dazzling you with that aspect of it. We decided, I think, to take a more naturalistic approach to that with the update, which, to my taste, I think is more what I like. But I think it's a valid interpretation, and people stayed for 4 hours and 45 minutes of the lyric to see it, which, disclaimer, we're not doing that.
Okay. Can you set up something for us to listen to, give us enough plot so we will understand the
And we're sort of lucky today. We have some music sung by some of our cast, and the first thing that we have is Cornelia, who is the widow of Pompeo or Pompey, and people don't take long to start wooing people who have just lost loved ones.
Yeah, pretty arduously.
And in this aria, she's been courted right away, and she says, "I'd rather die than have to live with this pain." And it's a beautiful aria, Priva Son, which, lucky enough, we'll hear sung by Yves Gigliotti, who's doing Cornelia in our production.
The wonderful Yves Gigliotti singing the role of Cornelia. My role of Sesto, I'm extremely fortunate because most of the time, maybe all of the time that I'm on stage, I'm with Cornelia because she's my mother. And indeed, in that aria, I get the best seat in the house. I'm embracing her at one point, and I get to hear that in every level. But I wanted to pick up the thread about the pants roles, because you look even into the 20th century, and you look at Richard Strauss making the choices of creating pants roles, let's say someone like Octavian, who's singing with Zofie or singing with the Marceline, and you also have this really sublime opportunity to have female voices be very sinuous and harmonious,
it's something that
can be stunning.
Different application, yeah.
Well, Handel really takes that to a really stunning level, I'd say, on a duet that mother and son sing together to, I think we're probably going to hear some of that. And that we close the first act with each of our devastation over the turn of events. And honestly, it's hard for me to imagine other voice parts on that other than this higher lyric mezzo and a deeper lyric mezzo, dramatic mezzo, singing those together. That musical opportunity is something that brings out an emotional quality that's impossible to ignore.
And their grief is particularly striking when we've heard about the head of, you know, the husband or father.
That's right.
She pleads for Ptolemaio's to be spared, and
right.
Then, lo and behold, whoops, too late for that, because
that's
his
right.
Head shows up in a box. And I guess, Ian, as Caesar, you're actually pretty upset about this, aren't you? Because, I mean, even though this man has been a rival of yours?
Oh, as Caesar.
Right. Oh, the character which you have played.
Which I've recorded. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but not in this particular production. Mm-hmm. But yes, the character of Caesar, played by you or someone else, has maybe a surprising reaction to this.
Yeah, absolutely. Caesar is just enraged by this. I think, you know, people will stage it in different sort of ways and create different sorts of subtext. But I think the presumption is that it was going to be a chance for him to be magnanimous in the situation and basically pardon Pompey, and then everybody in Egypt would love him all the more, and he would be ingratiated. But this murder that Ptolemaio orders his henchmen to carry out basically is the plot device that sets the rest of the opera into motion. So everything unfolds from this choice.
this is Sestel's first aria, his first reaction to the shock of understanding that his father has been killed. This is his first vengeance aria.
On that note of vengeance, we'll go more deeply into Handel's version of and the Florentine Opera Company's production of Julius Caesar. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our three guests, William Florescu, and also we have with us Ian Howell, and we have Adriana Zabala, and they are all part of the production this March 28th and 30th of the Florentine Opera Company of Milwaukee of Julius Caesar by Handel. And it is a fascinating blend of styles and voices and even time periods. And we were talking about with Adriana just now this role of Sesto, which is sung by a woman and has this kind of emotional power that you wouldn't find otherwise. How does that apply when we take it over to like a character such as Julius Caesar that you've played, Ian? Though not in this particular production, but here we have a countertenor singing the part of the most powerful man in the world. How does that work?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. So we have to understand this in the context of sort of gender norms. So we have a modern gender norm, and if I can just overly simplify it, it would be that there are sort of men which have masculine qualities and females which have feminine qualities, and there may be a little bit of intermixture, but basically we have these two gender poles, right? But in the 17th and 18th century, the context in which Handel and his contemporaries were writing for, you know, a castrato who's singing in the alto range, singing the role of the most powerful man in the world who has just conquered Egypt, it can be a little hard for us to understand. Like, why would a Roman general be singing high in a female range? And we have to understand that at the time, in the 17th and 18th centuries, a person's sort of gendered body was decoupled from, more powerfully, from their sense of masculinity and femininity, to the point that a contemporary audience for Handel would have understood that hearing Senesino sing Julius Caesar in a higher pitched range meant that Handel was saying that Julius Caesar was, there was more heightened drama in his voice because the higher range was associated with an intensity, with perhaps a vulnerability to being changed, with intense emotions that perhaps left the character more unstable. So a role like Sesto being written for a woman in Handel's time, Handel wouldn't have seen the incongruity of the gendered body of the performer because that voice would evoke a pitch range which speaks directly to the fact that this is a teenage boy who doesn't have the life experience to behave in a reserved, calm sort of manner. He just feels these emotions, speaks his mind, charges at Ptolemaio with a knife without thinking about what the consequences might be. And there is also an interesting side note to this, which is that the Royal Academy of Music, which was the group of people who performed this, they were a theater troupe. And so Handel hired a specific number of singers, and they had to sing all of the operas for the entire season.
Quite a range.
Yeah, so...
But they were paid for it, as you pointed out.
Well, they were very well paid for it, but they were the people that Handel had. So Berenstock.
So he wrote for the voices on hand.
He wrote for the voices on hand. Sure. Oh, and he hired the voices that he wanted to showcase. But Berenstock, who premiered Ptolemaio, then sings Flavio the next year and is the star of that opera. Secondary so role in this one.
If we think of then a high voice as being one under some kind of emotional duress, maybe a little bit of lack of control, what value do we put on those baritones and basses? I mean, in later tradition, I think of them as being, you know, in control for better or worse. You know, they are like the father figures or the villains. What does it play in Handel?
And we have a villain in this. Achilles is a bass baritone. And that voice really stands out in terms of what he's about. Also, Curio is also a bass. Again, he's the one who woos Cornelia on the front end. So they really stand out as being... having a particular color that means a particular thing. And it's with these different colors of voices that we have, it's a really interesting guide to the characters and what they're about.
And Ian, before we hear a sample of you as Caesar, can you just give us a definition of what is a countertenor?
Oh, a countertenor, it's a bit of it's a broadly applied term, but the easiest way to think about it is that it's a man whose voice has changed. So you hear my speaking voice. I'm, you know, sort of baritone Neil, perhaps, this morning. But they choose to sing with their voice much in the way probably that a mezzo-soprano or a soprano in their lower range would. So castrato had, you know, the voice box of a young boy and sang with the full voice just the way that a young boy would. A countertenor has the voice box of a grown man, but sings in a way that allows them to access that same pitch range.
Did Handel use both countertenors and castrati?
He did. Countertenors they certainly existed before the rise of the Italian castrati. Sort of, you know, they started coming into their prime in the very beginning of the 17th century in the Sistine Chapel. And their sound was so loud and so piercing. And, you know, the process of growing into... to be have a man's body but never really go through puberty caused bizarre changes. You would have these huge barrel chests, but these very small larynxes, very small vocal folds, and so you could take breaths and sing phrases that lasted for a minute. So there was a little bit of a carnival freak show, in the best sense of the word, element to the appeal of the castrati that a countertenor at the time couldn't match.
And it's a sound that's almost lost to history, isn't it? I mean, I think there's one recording made in like 1908 of a 75-year-old castrato.
But the problem was Mareschi was trained, so that recording was made first decade of the 20th century, and he was trained by late 19th century singers. So when you hear him sing, you hear what a romantic trained castrati might sound like rather than what we now call they didn't call it at the time, but what we now call a bel canto tradition.
Well, let's hear some of you.
Yeah, so this is Vatacito. This is a scene where Julius Caesar and Ptolemaio are basically sniffing each other out. And there's a lot of subtext, and they're sort of circling around one another. They're being very nice. It's a diplomatic introduction of two kings, basically. And Handel makes great use of a hunting horn here. So this is, to our ears, it just sounds like a French horn. But at the time, it would have been perhaps a slightly radical instrument to bring into the concert hall. And the message is very clear that Caesar is saying, I am the hunter, and you are the quarry.
be surprised.
Thank you.
knowing it's you and having heard you speak in a sort of more baritone voice, it really becomes then amazing to hear that transformation into a completely different sound.
What's the technique?
Well, it's a little complicated. I would say first and foremost, all of us have human voices, and human voices are capable of a wide range of sounds. I think that there is a strong cultural bias that young men inherit in at least just general Western culture, that women are supposed to make high sounds and men are not supposed to make high sounds. So I think a lot of the reason that hearing me sing like that appears special to some people is simply because I think most men are raised not to try.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, too, in the choral, because Ian toured with Chanticleer for many years.
Oh, did you?
And, yes. And groups like Chanticleer and the Kingsingers, people don't tend to have that issue with it either.
No,
when they hear
not
it in a choral setting. Mm-hmm. But as soon as you isolate it, it becomes like, oh, my gosh, what are you doing?
Mm-hmm. So. Adriana, you had mentioned the duet between, mother and son and how beautiful that is. Can you set that up so we can hear this? They're both grieving.
Exactly. And they have a different kind of grief, each of them. And yet, of course, the essential mystery and our compulsion to music is that it can make just a breathtaking harmony out of things that are similar but also different. I also just would like to, this duet is a perfect example, and it happens throughout the opera. It's just Handel's preternatural ability to find an emotional center and power of every piece. And I think it's why we're doing this 300 years later, that we wouldn't just be doing it if it were only a showcase for voices. That's spectacular and it's special, but it doesn't necessarily have staying power. Why does it continue to be done? Why was it revived in the 20th century and now become, we call it a masterpiece? If you come to our performance, I think it would be very difficult to deny the emotional immediacy of every single sound of music in the pit and on the stage. This is something that I'm very moved by and very happily perplexed by in the end, as much as we try to figure it out. In some sense, it goes back to one person's, with the conventions around them and their imagination, their ability to capture something that is true for all people. And this opera is a pageant of that emotion.
So this is mother and son in grief for the murdered...
Father and husband.
Ptolemaio.
That's right. A Pompeii.
Pompeii.
That's right.
What about the reception of this opera, Julius Caesar, in London in 1724? Again, as I said at the top, it's a German composer in England writing for English audiences, but the whole thing's in Italian. How did that play out?
About a Roman in Egypt.
Very well. The short answer is very well. Handel was specifically sort of cultivated by the man who became George I, met him in Italy. And that relationship led to Handel being invited to come to London. And, you know, this organization, the Royal Academy of Music, was formed, which he wasn't even the main director of at the time. But the chair of that board basically said, "You, Handel, shall go to Italy, and you shall go bring us some Italian singers." So there was, within the aristocracy, at least at the time, there was a great desire for that foreign style, because it was the best singing. It's a language that you can set very beautifully and elegantly to music, and everybody knew it.
But you'll be using English subtitles for your production.
Correct. Yes, absolutely.
So. I guess the English of 1724 didn't worry too much about the literal meaning word for word.
There would be a libretto. You'd have an English translation.
Oh, everyone did have a copy of the libretto.
They were happy to sell to you.
Yes. Yeah, there you go. Well, again, Handel was very enterprising.
No doubt. And there are also many records of people who were in attendance in those first several performances. They all wrote about it in their diaries, whether that was for thinking about grandiose one-upmanship for posterity, thinking, well, I want everyone to know I was there, so this was an event, or some sincere reaction to a work of art. We can't necessarily tell, but it was definitely a thing. As we say,
it was very competitive too, wasn't it? Opera production in London in those early years.
There were competing companies, and it was no less political than the claques of the 1950s at the Met between Tibaldi and Callas and the Islamists. It was perhaps even more so.
And they would actually steal arias from each other, and then they'd try to, if somebody was mounting a production of a certain opera, the other company would try to mount theirs just before it.
Mm-hmm.
It was amazing how cutthroat it all was.
Even within Julius Caesar, at the time, it would have been very strange for... Okay, so Julius Caesar and Cleopatra are sort of the primary roles within this opera. But because of political conniving and one-upsmanship and all of this, both the first and the second act end with Sesto and Cornelia, because those specific singers... like through tantrums and required. It's a place of honor to be able to sing the last aria before a curtain falls. That's a sign of respect towards the singer themselves.
More on the production of Julius Caesar when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and we are talking about Julius Caesar by Handel, which is being performed in Milwaukee by the Florentine Opera Company. And we have three members of that here with us today, William Florescu, and also Adriana Zabala, and Ian Howell. And we're getting some taste of this incredibly theatrical work that will be produced on March 28th and March 30th. In the case of Caesar and Cleopatra, we normally don't think of them. We think of Anthony and Cleopatra. But tell us a little bit about the romance between these two larger-than-life characters.
So I'll take a shot at that. I would say basically that from the minute Cleopatra sees Julius Caesar, she decides that he shall be hers and sets out scheming in the entire rest of the story to make that happen. The selection I think we're going to listen to in a second is one of these pivotal moments when Cleopatra has spirited Caesar into her room in the palace, and then there's rustling outside, and it's obviously a trap that Ptolemaio has set to kill Caesar, and Caesar's immediate reaction is to a lampo dell'armi, light the lamps of war, because he's going to draw his sword and rush out into the hallway to fight every soldier that he can. But just as a sign of the influence that Cleopatra has had on him already in her seduction, she convinces him instead to jump out the window and land in the water and swim away to safety. So this aria is just a great example of a technique that was very common in Handel's time, which is the use of coloratura. It's an opportunity for the singer through the character to display great rage and great emotion just through a very virtuosic music.
So reportedly, I mean, history tells us that Cleopatra wasn't necessarily conventionally beautiful, which
right.
came as a shock, I think, in biographies of the 20th and 21st century, because we think of her as this amazing seductress. So our Cleopatra and Handel's Cleopatra is at least a double threat in wit and in arias. Ours is, I would say, I'm going to say a quadruple threat. she's gorgeous. She's a beautiful young woman, avapine. The arias are incredible that Handel gives her, and she sings them like a goddess. And thirdly, her costumes are unbelievable. Our costume designers are artists, of course, and they're in full display in the in Cleopatra's costumes, and of course intelligence and wit.
So
and
no
she
wonder,
can dance.
So no wonder Caesar falls.
So I guess that's five.
So no wonder Caesar falls. Involved.
Exactly.
She tells him to jump out a window. He's going to jump out a window.
Yes, yeah. But he's going to sing for a while first.
That's right. And we fall in love too, and that's the exciting thing.
Hopefully not too much for the moment, but yes.
I'm still getting used to that as the sound for Julius Caesar. It does, as you mentioned, it goes against our modern conceptions.
Yeah, I think it absolutely does. But I don't know that you necessarily need to understand all the historical backstory mm-hmm. to, you get two or three arias into this and you realize, wow, this is a really dramatically heroic character. And I think the sort of projection of what you would expect from a gendered body sort of starts falling away. You just listen to the music.
And if you had to pick out one aria that stands out in terms of Cleopatra, what would it be?
Well, I think her signature aria is in the last act, Piangero la sorte mia, where she thinks the battle has been lost and she thinks Caesar is dead. And before the happy ending happens in the opera, we have this moment of sublime sadness where she sings of her sadness, and it really is quite touching, and it's really a signature aria for a lot of sopranos who do this role and a lot of this type of repertory.
Cordelia, e sesto, e non ne son, ne son.
perhaps.
The Cleopatra you usually think of, you know, as being the scheming, treacherous ruler of Egypt, but put in place by Caesar. I gather in terms of the character development in this opera that, as you've implied, Adriana, the character of Cleopatra goes from political ambitions towards Caesar toward actually falling in love with him, and I gather that's reciprocal on his part. He also makes that change.
We wouldn't have an opera if it weren't.
Yes.
Got to have that in there somewhere.
It's almost hard to believe it
has a happy ending.
I was just thinking, too, how beautiful sadness can be in music.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
This opera has an interesting parallel to Coronation of Poppaea, where you have two lead characters who we don't generally think of as positively.
Yeah, right.
As these operas make you feel about them at the end. Because it's Nero and Poppaea are the same thing. They have this beautiful ending together, and that you think really good about them. And then you read some history, and you think, maybe not so good.
Yeah. not so good. What about your character, Sesto? I mean, he's out for revenge.
Yes, he's out for revenge, and he does develop, especially in this production, I'd say. And, you know, contrary to our kind of reigning popular culture, in the movie we want the bad guy to be punished, and when the bad guy is punished, we applaud and all of that. So you would think that once Sesto achieves his vengeance, that he might feel purged of that and ready to move forward with confidence, and he's become a man and all of that. He does indeed kill Tolomeo.
The killer of his father.
He avenges his father's death. And with swiftness is left to feel even more empty and more profoundly troubled, which, of course, is a more realistic take on a terribly violent act.
Yes.
Much more complex.
So, yes.
So I have a question for the three of you. Let's say I'm listening from somewhere in the state and I'm considering coming to Milwaukee to see this production. What am I going to miss if I don't come to see it?
The finest music in the world.
Yeah.
But what about this particular performance of this particular opera?
I can speak a little. We were talking about characterization here, and it's if you look at sort of the totality of the arias and the arc of character development that Handel actually just puts onto the score, Caesar and Cleopatra are incredibly complicated characters, which was notable for the time. Several of the other characters are a little one-dimensional, and our stage director, Eric, from day one, he made a point to figure out, you know, what is the actual person? Like, who is this person? Who is Sesto? So Handel gives Sesto all this anger and all this rage, and that's what comes off of the page. But to actually find the motivation behind that and the complexity of why Sesto behaves in certain ways, or the reason that Tolomeo, my character, behaves in certain ways. He's not just a jerk throughout the entire opera, you know, and that's what's on the page. So I think what they'll miss is a really, at times disturbing and at times beautiful, but really interesting perspective on human nature, on the feelings that they have themselves and the way that they react to challenges in their own lives.
What about action in Handel's operas and Julius Caesar in particular?
Well, I did say that Senesino came in on a horse.
Yeah, well, right. But I gather you're not going to have that in this production.
No, we fought for it, but no horse. No, there is quite a good deal of action on stage. The actual set is rather large, and it's multi-leveled, and there are multiple ramps, there are multiple staircases. So there's quite a good deal of artistically meaningful running about and chasing people and throwing people around and catching people and arresting people. There's
very, very active.
We're all very active.
And beautiful, very meaningful, large projected images
that deepen
the sense of certain pieces and emotions and relationships. They'll miss an incredible story that's resonant and pertinent and timely because it's human, and of course phenomenal music.
Best music.
Rather mind expanding too when you put it all together.
Heart and mind, I would say.
Well, yes, thanks for that amendment. But yes, when you put together the various gender switches.
Yeah.
And the setting that which you have put in the years around World War I.
Yes.
Which you'd say, Bill, actually is a good parallel to the relationship between Italy and Egypt in the time of Caesar.
You know, what I think people will miss living in the state of Wisconsin, and it's interesting with Madison Opera doing Dead Man Walking coming up, what they're going to miss is being in a state where they can see really world-class performers and see the bookends of the time frame of right. the operatic art form mm-hmm. within 70 miles of another right. with each other. So this is the opportunity to see the Baroque side of it. And then, you know, Madison has Dead Man Walking coming up. So I would say that it's happening right here. And I think a lot of people, and you guys do a great job of letting people know this, that you can experience that here. And I think sometimes people feel they need to get on a jet and go somewhere else, and they don't have to.
Good point. And thanks for joining us. And filling us in a little bit about the Florentine Opera Company production of Handel's Julius Caesar, March 28th and 30th. That's Friday and Sunday in Milwaukee. And our guests today have been General Director William Florescu, and with us also two of the players in this opera, two of the great voices that you'll be hearing, Adriana Zabala, Sesto, and singing the part of Tolomeo, Ian Howell. Pleasure having you with us.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.